A funny thing happened on the way to the Lotus Sutra. I ran into a lecture by Suzuki Roshi while looking for his introductory lecture to his series on the Lotus Sutra back in the 60s. And in the same volume was a nice article that he wrote, or a lecture that he gave that was transcribed and put in this collection of articles. It was on the precepts. And I know Kokyo has gone through the 16 precepts, one each week, 16 weeks on these precepts. And I thought maybe I'd just finish it up with some of Suzuki's ideas that I thought was pretty good, a nice formulation about Zazen precepts and the ceremonies we do here all being one. I've been going to the Monterey group where Catherine on Sundays has been talking about the Lotus Sutra. And sometimes lines pop out. They catch you, catch me. And you look in other translations and a few words are changed and they come across as kind of flat. But in the translation that we're using with Catherine, they refer to Buddha. The Dharma King is the breaker of ideas of being. And I just thought that was a nice summary of Buddha coming into the world and shaking things up a little bit, making his disciples look at their lives, look at the universe in a very different way, and it caught on. And we're sitting here with the body and mind of Buddha today. In this introductory lecture from Suzuki Roshi on the Lotus Sutra, he tells how the Lotus Sutra is spoken by the Sambhogakaya, one of the three bodies of Buddha. The language in the Lotus Sutra is Baroque, very ornate, colorful, and it is reported that this particular manifestation of Buddha's body and mind was the voice of the Lotus Sutra, the Sambhogakaya. Kokyo talked about these three bodies of Buddha last week. One of them is the Nirmanakaya, the manifest body, the physical body that Buddha lived in and taught in 2,500 years ago and lived 80 years. The next body is the Sambhogakaya, which Kokyo called the bliss body, which is the usual way that we call that the bliss body. And we get a vision, a feeling, we embody this Sambhogakaya bliss body, for instance, after a weekend sesshin when we're all sitting here quietly hour after hour. And at the end of the 2.5 days of sitting, we're just so grateful for the practice. We can't wait to tell the people sitting next to us how inspiring their meditation was for our weekend. We can't wait to tell the cook how delicious the food is. Our minds are a little more spacious, a little receptive. This is the sensation or the experience of the bliss body is sometimes described that way. In Suzuki's introduction, he also calls it the truth body. He says it's the way things are. This body is the way things are, is the truth in the universe. He describes it as kind of the sun shining. The sun isn't aware that it's kind of warming the earth, warming our bodies, the fuel of all that goes on here on earth. It doesn't have that awareness. It's just filling its, as Dogen says, its total dynamic functioning. It's playing its vital role in the interconnectedness of all beings. That's the source of truth for us. And that's how Suzuki described this Sambhogakaya body. He said this was it expresses the interconnectedness, the causes and conditions of the universe. Kind of the active nature of it. If we think of our life here as receiving causes and conditions like temperature and oxygen, the changes of the seasons, the stresses at work or at home, all of these are the causes and conditions that make up our lives moment after moment. These same causes and conditions are affecting, are swirling around. They're the total dynamic functioning of the universe. The reality of this is the Sambhogakaya in its active way. Suzuki is a little vaguer or a little harder for me to understand when he describes the Dharmakaya, the third body of Buddha, which he also calls the truth body. He calls them the same thing, which is part of the confusion for me. But he says that reality of the causes and conditions of the universe is the stillness of that whole process, the inactivity, the no activity of the reality of the universe. So that's how Suzuki described these three bodies of Buddha. And I want to say more about the Sambhogakaya, which is why I brought it up. He said a nice thing, though, that I don't want to forget about the Nirmanakaya, this manifest body, this body that walks on earth and talks on earth and teaches on earth. He says that we take on the Nirmanakaya body when we live a life of vow rather than the life of karma. So at some point we're aware that that these causes and conditions that we're all subject to are the karma that we are experiencing right here and right now on earth. As a matter of fact, we've got certain innate karma just being in this human body. You know, sometimes We have aches and pains. We can't escape old age, sickness, and death. All of this is just kind of the built-in wiring of inheriting this body. This is our karma of being human beings. But we can be the bodhisattvas of the world, the nirmanakayas of the world, by living our vow, whether our vow is to save all beings, the way Buddha taught, to end suffering, the way Buddha taught, whether it's to live our lives by the 16 precepts, or they're kind of like the 10 commandments in Buddhism. But that's the subtle transformation between living a life of karma versus a life of vow, and becoming nirmanakaya or bodhisattva because of these vows. So Suzuki says that precepts, zazen, and our ceremonies or rituals are all one. Especially here in the Soto Zen school, our practice is really the practice of our daily lives. In our lives we sit, in our lives we work, in our lives we wash, we have relationships, and in our lives we do ceremonies and rituals here in the Zendo. And this is where we bring our practice to all these aspects of our daily life. There is no difference in our practice whether we're sitting here quietly in the Zendo or outside of the Zendo. And our practice is bringing our true selves, our true nature, to this present moment, experiencing that our deepest self right here in the moment with each breath. There's a Vipassana teacher here in town, Bob Stahl, who says about meditation that we expand our awareness and watch our breath because we've developed a curiosity about our consciousness, about our minds and our bodies. So he asks us in our meditation, as we follow our breath, just stay curious about what thoughts are arising. Stay curious about what sensations in your body are arising. Stay curious about what sounds come into your ears while you're sitting, or what smells, or how your clothes feel on your skin. But just develop that curiosity. And I think this curious, receptive mind is our true self, our true nature. We're poised moment after moment, just experiencing this body and this mind. Like Dogen says, we're totally and dynamically functioning in this universe as we follow our breath and remaining curious about what's arising in our bodies, minds, and in the universe at any given moment. We're not sitting here with the question, who am I? What am I doing? What should my role be? We're just participating in the total dynamic functioning of the universe. And I think this is Suzuki Roshi's image of the Sambhogakaya, the shining sun. That's our meditation. in our ceremonies that we do here. You know, we it's a ceremony just coming in the room, beginning Zazen. We do a bow at the door. We walk in with our hands in a certain way. We bow to the cushion. We bow to the room. We swing our legs around clockwise. It starts out as a ceremony from the very beginning. And it doesn't stop there. Each morning we do our morning service, a ritual with prostrations and chanting and more bows. We develop this intimacy with the present moment and our body when we're paying attention to what comes next, which bow comes next, which chant comes next. And even if we resist some of the formality of the ceremonies and rituals that we do, just hanging in there, like Rosa, just hanging in there, waiting for what's next, bringing our body and mind to that moment. We even get more intimate with the mind of resistance. Or lo and behold, on some rare mornings we get intimate with the harmonies. When Chris is going with the low notes in the morning, and Kokyo has the tenor part, and Nanette takes on the soprano role, we even become intimate with the harmonious mind. So our ceremonies, as well as our zazen, allow this true self to meet the moment, and we're able to experience our true selves moment after moment. Suzuki says that, you know, when we hold the chant books in a certain way, or we begin a chant on the third bell, that we're also practicing responding to each other. He asks us to see our ceremonies, you know, not as something outside of our ordinary lives, but really very much a part of our ordinary lives. You know, the beginning of this lecture on precepts, ceremonies, and zazen, it sounds like Suzuki was responding to an observation that, you know, I like sitting in the Zendo okay, but I just can't get into these ceremonies. Or why does Zen have to be so formal? So it sounds like he was really addressing that question. And so he talked about, you know, our ceremonies that we do here aren't really so different than our ordinary lives. You know, some of our ceremonies are memorial ceremonies for people who have died that we want to remember. And, you know, there's people in my life that have died, and people talk to me and about people in their lives that have died. So we do a ritual on remembering those that have died. We do chants and ceremonies on getting well. And, you know, we're at work or we're at school or we see friends and we're wishing them well all the time. And so our getting well ceremony is pretty ordinary. It's a pretty ordinary thing that we're celebrating. You know, we do ceremonies here when somebody takes on a new Zendo role, like when we welcome the new head student, or we welcome the new work leader. We do a ceremony of welcoming, and we're greeting people every day in our lives. So we make a little ceremony out of a pretty ordinary function of our daily lives. When we're sitting here for the weekend and we're doing orioki, we're serving the meals. We do a ceremony about offering food. And, you know, I'm cooking every day. I serve somebody something every day. Somebody serves something to me every day. So we've made a little ritual about eating. And so rituals are pretty ordinary, or at least they're celebrating pretty ordinary parts of our lives. And Suzuki says, you know, we're practicing with these pretty ordinary things in our lives. When we're chanting about the memorial service, we're adding a few Dharma words. We're chanting sutras around death and dying. What a nice thing to think about when somebody at work says their parent has died. Wouldn't it be great if sutra words came to mind that I could offer? But of course, as I've said, and as Suzuki pointed out, in service we've also got that true nature, our deepest nature, our true self, that's meeting the moment just as we're holding the chant books, or just as we're saying the chant. So it's our big mind, it's our deepest self that's offering these Dharma words to a friend whose family has died. So Suzuki would like us to practice this interaction with people around these ordinary events in our life. Practice over and over again, experiencing our deepest self as it meets the moment. And that's why he's recommended that we practice over and over again our sitting and our rituals, so that we become familiar with this, with our deepest self, and we talk and we act out of that self. He says, we practice responding appropriately to each other in these sutras, and then your life will have no more problems, he says. What a great thing. And so I'm willing to practice for that reason. If there's any gain at all in this, it'd be nice not to have any more problems. But he says that. Practice this over and over as much as you can. How to respond to people during these ordinary parts of our lives. So these are ordinary life situations. We're gesturing, we're acknowledging each other, all with big mind and true self that experiences fully the actual moment, the actual situation. A quote from Suzuki. So the actual feeling of rituals cannot be understood without observing them. You have to do this. The actual feeling of rituals cannot be understood without observing them. When you observe them, you have the actual feeling of the rituals. As long as you try to know what it means or why you do it, it's going to be difficult to feel your actual being in this place. So he'd like us to suspend thinking about why we do these services, or when, or just, you know, pondering. He asks us, just do it. Just participate. See what it feels like to bring that body to the moment where you're asked to hold the sutra cards in a certain way, to chant in a certain way. Just give it a try. See what you meet. He asks us to avoid actions that you base on figuring out what other people's motives are. That's a good one. It's politics. I've been watching the BBC about the incredible tripartite political maneuverings in England. And, you know, it's they're not so different than our politics. But, you know, we do a little politicking in our own lives every day. You know, if I say this, what's that going to make me vulnerable for? Or I'm going to wait till I hear what they have to say before I respond. Suzuki encourages us to just practice these rituals where we're bringing our deepest self to each moment and try to respond intuitively, more intuitively and spontaneously out of that deeper self than kind of putting a political spin into each moment. He says if you're second guessing people, you will force something. I thought that was a nice way of saying that it's going to be a little bit, it's going to be a little stiff. It's going to be a little jagged. But if you've got all this practice of responding to death, responding to getting well, responding to saying hello, responding to stepping back, if you've got all this practice of responding with your true self and Dharma word after Dharma word, what's that going to look like in your life? He uses the word intuitive. Respond intuitively. So he's pretty unapologetic when he says that to be a Buddhist is to follow a lot of rules. You have to follow rules. So when we're told to hold the chant cards in a certain way or to chant at a certain time, these ceremonies become rituals. You know, we do them over and over again in the same way. Those are the rules of the rituals. When I was telling Rosa about our monthly introduction to Zen and Zazen instruction, she'll learn the rules on how you sit at the cushion. And at the end of that, you'll get your diploma that says you know how to do Zazen sitting meditation. But so the rules of sitting on the cushion is called Zazen. And the rules for our life are called the precepts. These 16 suggestions, suggestions on how to get along, on how to make your way through the world, are the precepts, is our practice of precepts. But Suzuki says that the practice of these precepts is the expression, is the very expression of our true nature, our true selves. That intuitive response that we've been practicing over and over again, doing service in the morning, during our rituals. This is the same true nature, the same true self that emerges with the practice of these 16 precepts. In Zazen and during the rituals, our mind becomes more still, and we're dropping some of our usual patterns of emotional response. We're watching frustration arise, perhaps, and letting it go. So we're practicing a different response to our emotions. So Zazen and ritual practices is a practice of selflessness. And when we practice the precepts that sound a lot like the Ten Commandments, a disciple of Buddha does not kill, does not steal, doesn't lie. It helps us get along and become less selfish. Somebody else lectured in this book, and they said they could never tell whether Suzuki, with his accent, was saying selfless or selfish. The transcriber of Suzuki's lecture here said selfish and selfless. So these precepts practice, we become less selfish, so that actually Zazen and ritual practice and the practice of the 16 precepts are a practice of selflessness. So Suzuki was kind of giving us a lesson on big mind, on true self, true nature, on how to become familiar with that. You start when you're just by yourself, sitting and following your breath. You extend that to doing ritual practice with others, where you're given a script on responding to memorials and welcomings and meals and each other by giving a script, said by your true self, your true nature. And then you take it on the road out into the world with precept practice. So you're practicing all the time with this, with your deeper self, with this big mind that's just meeting the moment just as it is. So he's giving us a lesson on how to bring this big mind practice, this true nature practice, from the cushion out into the complex world that we all live in. He says, this is a very important point. To feel your being here in this moment is a very important practice. I'll say that again. To feel your being here in this moment is a very important practice. He goes on, that is the point of observing precepts and observing rituals and practicing Zazen. To feel or be yourself at a certain time, in a certain place. That is why we practice our way. That's the whole works. That's the whole works. He talks specifically about the precepts, and he uses the precept of preserving life, of not killing, as an example of precept practice. He reminds us that all the precepts, all 16, are contained in any given one precept. So whatever precept you're practicing with at any given time, they're all in there. They're all in there. And he says the same thing about rituals. Whether we're doing the memorial service or whether we're chanting during the Oryoki meal practice, each ceremony is contained in all the others. So he says when you're eating your brown rice, it's already too late to think about not killing, because someone has had to protect the rice plants from the insects, for instance. So he says, in your own life, why don't you start this meal as he instructed. When you start your meal with our meal chant, innumerable labors have brought us this food, we should know how it comes to us. Just by starting off with that, where we've already closed the gap and become more intimate with our meal, with our rice, with how food comes to us, with how we've already kind of gotten interested in our food, and we're right there at the moment with the bowl of rice before us and our true nature meeting that moment along with the bowl of rice. So he's encouraging us to bring a little ritual to our daily lives as well. We've brought this true being to the moment. We've begun protecting the environment. We've already begun reducing suffering and expressing our true nature and practicing the precepts just by chanting the meal chant. We're expressing our vow through experiencing our true being in this moment. Suzuki says it's hard work being a Buddhist, following all these rules. He even asks us to sit every day. You know, that's the part in the echo where we say, you know, tranquility of daily practice. He's assuming that we've already carved out a spot every day to do our sitting practice. So he says, it's hard work following all these rules. But maybe someday you'll just say, I'll do it. And that's the same thing as not killing insects. Just turning to, okay, I'll do it, is the whole cascade of practicing precepts, sitting zazen, doing rituals. They're not separate. He sums up this lecture saying, let me remind you that practicing precepts is chewing your rice. If you don't chew, you don't get the flavor from rice. Practicing precepts is to get the real taste of Buddhism. Quote, if you practice them one by one, that is how you chew your rice and how you practice our way. Any thoughts? Did anybody read that lecture? I want to thank Harry for loaning me his book. This book's been out about 5 years, and this is an old lecture from the 60s that I think was first printed in the late 60s or early 70s and reprinted a few years ago. Rosie.
As you were speaking, I was suddenly struck by the, you said a number of times, used the word encourage or encouraging or encouragement. I was thinking, maybe the precepts could be taken not as rules sometimes. We could say, they're encouragements. And they do feel like they encourage me.
Mm-hmm.
Encouragement to, you know, wake up and notice this.
Mm-hmm.
Encouraging.
Yeah.
Encouragements.
Yeah. I've also heard them described as kind of templates. If your life of vow is to keep the precepts close to your mind and body, that you it might be thought that they might be thought of as, you know, kind of templates to overlay your life on which to overlay your life and try to fit in. And sometimes they will, and sometimes you're going to notice that, oh, it's not quite the right fit. Let me look at that. Let me take a close look at it. Let me bring some attention to that discord. So I like that term too, template. Thank you. Delusions are inexhaustible.